Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 16, 2016, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special courthouse steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss today's Supreme Court decision in a False Claims Act case, Universal Health Care Services. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to Teleform today two experts, Shane Kelly and Mark Sweet. They are both with the law firm Wiley Ryan right here in Washington, D.C. They're going to give us opening remarks, including some background on the case, and then discuss today's opinion, about 15, 20, 25, 30 minutes, as many as 30 minutes. But then, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions. We'll have an announcement when the audience questions begin, so please do be ready with your questions. With that, let's go right to the program. Mr. Kelly, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Yes, my name is Shane Kelly, and I'm an attorney at Wiley Ryan. My practice consists of, you know, a lot of False Claims Act cases, along with my colleague Mark Sweet. And so, this is a big case. We're excited about it. It means means quite a bit for our practice. So the case concerns the False Claims Act, which is the general fraud statute for the federal government. This is a big case because it really defined the scope of the statute in an important way, and the statute, you know, results in several billion dollars in recoveries per year for the federal government. So it's not a forgotten statute. It's really actively used in a lot of different ways. And this case has a lot of implications for the government contracts world and healthcare providers, really anybody who interacts with the federal government on a regular basis. So that's kind of the bottom line of why it's important. Just as we go through the discussion to give you a brief roadmap of where we're going, first I'll give a summary of some background on the False Claims Act so that everybody has kind of an understanding of the statutory structure. Then we'll talk about the facts of this case in particular so that we all know kind of what the court was reviewing. And then we'll talk about the theory that was adopted by the Supreme Court. They upheld an implied certification theory under the False Claims Act, and they also really changed the materiality standard for the statute. And finally, we will discuss the implications for the wider False Claims Act jurisprudence and for everyone who does business with the government. So as I said, the False Claims Act is the general fraud statute, but it excludes tax issues. One unique feature that I think is important here is that it allows private parties to sue in the name of the government and then receive a portion of the recovery. So a private party can decide they want to bring a lawsuit on behalf of the federal government. The statute creates liability for treble damages and civil penalties up to $10,000 for violations, which is one of the reasons it's such a big deal. It's a very punitive statute that has a really large liability in a lot of instances. It's important for government contractors and healthcare providers because they are regularly submitting claims for payment to the federal government. And so, you know, whether or not those claims are considered fraudulent in some way really impacts their entire revenue stream. So the basic element of the statute is that it prohibits the knowing submission of a false or fraudulent claim or a false record or statement material to a false or fraudulent claim. So there are kind of four basic elements there. First, the claim in order to violate the statute has to be false or fraudulent. And there is no statutory definition of what a false or fraudulent claim is, and it's subject to judicial interpretation. And that is where the issue in United Health Services falls. It's all about what constitutes a false or fraudulent claim. The other elements, just to go through briefly, are that it has to be kind of a request or demand for payment, a claim. The false claim has to be submitted knowingly, so with actual knowledge, deliberate ignorance, or reckless disregard for the truth. And the materiality standard under the statute for some violations is that there is a natural tendency to influence or be capable of influencing the payment or receipt of money or property. So those are the basic elements. What was really at issue here is a species of falsity called implied certifications. So one way a claim can be false is if it just has incorrect facts on it. So you submit a claim for payment to the federal government for, 500 hours that employees have worked when they've only actually worked 300. So that's often been called kind of a factual falsity. There's also been false express certifications. So where a contractor, signs a paper when they submit a claim for payment saying that there's no conflicts of interest, in the administration of the contract, when in fact there is a conflict of interest in the administration of the contract. So some courts refer to that as legal falsity if you are, making an express representation that you've complied with a set of rules or regulations. When that representation is false, that makes the claim for payment false. What was at issue here, though, is a different type of legal falsity where courts have said that just by submitting a claim for payment, you are impliedly representing that you have complied with the relevant contract terms and regulatory requirements. So even if you're not saying, explicitly, I followed all the rules, when you submit a claim for payment, you're implying that you have a right to payment because you've done what you're supposed to do. So that is the general theory as it's been discussed, and it is very controversial in part because it just seems to be kind of boundless once you start to think about it. Any contract violation or regulatory violation could potentially be considered fraud because, if you're violating one of 100 or 1,000 regulations and you're submitting claims for payment, a court could say, well, you weren't doing what you were supposed to do. And so the facts of I'll turn it over to Mark Sweet to discuss the facts specifically of the case in Escobar.
Thanks, Shane. So in Escobar, there was a patient in a Massachusetts clinic who was being treated for mental health problems. And the patient was prescribed a drug by one of the professionals at the clinic. The patient then had an adverse reaction to the drug and ultimately passed away. Shortly after the patient passed away, the family of the patient discovered that many of the staff at the clinic were not licensed to practice or authorized to prescribe medicine. And why this becomes a False Claims Act case is that the patient in this case was a Medicare beneficiary. So in other words, the clinic here had registered to participate in Medicare and receive reimbursement of its services through Medicare. And to do that, it had its staff members register. They got federal ID numbers, which required them to make certain representations about their qualifications and their licensing. And those ID numbers were then tied to specific titles or positions at the clinic. The clinic, when it would submit a claim to CMS, the government agency that administers Medicare, would submit claims that use certain codes that would correspond to the particular services that had been provided, and it would use the ID numbers of the particular doctors and nurses and other staff members who were performing those services. And the allegation here is that the clinic had submitted false claims because what they had done is they had made representations in their claims for payment about the specific services they had provided and the specific types of professionals who had provided them, but they hadn't disclosed that there were ongoing violations of very important state regulations governing the licensing and the qualifications of professionals who perform mental health services. And as Shane mentioned, this was a case about implied certification. So here, there was nothing in the claims that explicitly said that the clinic was complying with all state regulations regarding mental health services. But the allegation was that by submitting these claims for payment that certain professionals had performed certain services, the clinic had allegedly implied that it was complying with these state regulations governing people who perform these types of services. And so the court was looking at whether, in this case, the fact that they did that the clinic didn't specifically say anything about its compliance with these state regulations still put it in a position to violate the False Claims Act. And as Shane's going to talk about now, the court ultimately ruled that it did violate the False Claims Act, or that it could violate the False Claims Act.
And so the opinion was unanimous from the court in an opinion written by Justice Thomas, which was a little bit of a surprise. I was actually able to attend oral argument, and I thought it could go this way just because all the questions seemed to be, you know, in support of the implied certification theory. Ultimately, the court found that the theory was valid, in contrary to some of the circuit courts. And they basically said, you know, the word fraud generally is supposed to relate to common law fraud. So where Congress uses a word, you would assume that the common law definition should be implied. And here, the court said, well, under the common law fraud, fraudulent omissions are a clear part of what fraud means. And in particular, Justice Thomas looked at cases where, you know, there had been a representation that made that was then misleading without disclosing another fact, you know, a fraudulent omission. So I think one of the cases cited was an old famous Cardozo case where, you know, someone sold a piece of land saying there would be two roads, you know, going next to it, but failed to disclose there was going to be a third road that was going to go right through the piece of property. So that was held to be a fraudulent omission. And the court essentially said here, well, why don't we just look at the statute, interpret the plain meaning in light of the common law history, and say that, you know, where a party doing business with the government makes a representation and they fail to disclose, you know, a material fact is what they refer to that's related to that representation, then that is fraud, and therefore that falls under the False Claims Act. And so in United Health Services, the court looked specifically at the payment codes used by the clinic, and they said, you know, when you're submitting that claim for payment under Medicaid, you're representing that you are conducting individual therapy or family therapy. And so if you are making that representation while at the same time failing to comply with what it called core Medicaid regulations in Massachusetts, then then those representations are in your claim for payment are misleading, even though you didn't certify compliance with all those regulations. And so the ultimate holding was that there can be implied certification violations of the False Claims Act, at least when two conditions are satisfied. It said, first, the claim does not merely request payment, but also makes specific representations about the goods or services provided. And second, the defendant's failure to disclose noncompliance with material, statutory, regulatory, or contractual requirements makes those representations misleading half-truths. So they find you can find implied certifications in claims for payment. However, it has to relate to a specific representation that was made in the claim for payment. And this is really entirely different from any rubric that the lower courts had used for the past 20 years. And so, which is one of the reasons this is kind of a revolutionary case. It's going to spawn a lot of new inquiries in cases. And I'll let Mark discuss how they handled some of that.
Yeah, and I'll just make clear, in case we haven't already, this case was initially dismissed at the district court level on a motion to dismiss, which is a sort of early check in the legal proceedings process on whether a plaintiff has adequately pled a case. And so in other words, the district court had not gotten through the discovery period, had not reached any kind of merits on the case. The court here had dismissed it. By the time it got to the Supreme Court, though, they've overturned that now, and it's been sent back to the district court, the First Circuit, for further proceedings. But the idea is this case could proceed along for a determination on the merits. So nothing's been decided yet as to whether this defendant has in particular violated the False Claims Act. It's going to be a question, though, that an open question now that the Supreme Court has at least acknowledged that this is that the plaintiff's theory here could be valid. All right. So the second part of this, the decision was the court's consideration of the condition of payment test. And the condition of payment test is something that had been created in recent years by judges to, I think, kind of put some checks or some boundaries on the growing or expanding nature of False Claims Act liability. And the idea of the condition of payment test was that for courts that had recognized the implied certification theory was that there ought to be some limit. You can't apply to every single possible regulatory violation or statutory violation or contractual violation out there. So courts had imposed something called condition of payment test where they had said that the implied certification theory only comes up where the violation was an express condition of payment. So that usually is something that is a term of the contract or some other statute or regulation that the government has identified as being important to it in the contractual relationship. But the court rejected that here. They said, on one hand, it's too broad because, well, what if the government identified every single law or regulation as a potential condition of payment? And on the other hand, it's too narrow. It can't be that the False Claims Act only applies to terms that have been specifically and expressly identified by the government. But ultimately, it's just not a practical test. It's not practical for the government to have to go through and identify all of their potential conditions of payment and what they consider to be important. And it's not practical for a company or an individual doing business with the government or participating in a program to have to think about every single potential violation out there with all these, you know, the complex regulatory schemes and determine whether there's risk of False Claims Act liability with each one. I think ultimately what doomed the condition of payment test is that it's not based on the language of the statute. It really is a judicially conceived test. There's nothing in the False Claims Act that uses the words condition of payment. It's something that courts had conceived of, especially in recent years, I think mostly in response to the 2009 amendments, what we often call FERA or the Fraud Enforcement Recovery Act of 2009. That was the first time that the statute had implemented a definition of materiality. And the definition of materiality, as Shane alluded to earlier, is fairly weak in the statute. It refers to something, the natural tendency to influence the government in making a payment. And that is pretty broad, as you can imagine. Almost anything can have the tendency to influence the government, even if it doesn't actually influence the government. And so courts had kind of come up with this idea of condition of payment as a check on that. And because you've got a watered-down materiality provision, they've come up with this idea of condition of payment as another way to limit the growing liability under the False Claims Act. But the court here said, no way, that's not in the statute, and we don't recognize it, doesn't make sense as a test. And so what they've done instead is bulked up the materiality element of the False Claims Act. So rather than just rely solely on this statutory provision saying it's the natural tendency to influence, they've looked to the common law and the idea that you know, it needs to be something significant. It needs to be something that matters to the government. That would take into consideration conditions of payment, things that have been expressly identified by the government. But it's not necessarily conditions of payment. So in other words, conditions of payment are not dispositive. They're relevant, but they're not dispositive. It also takes into consideration what the defendant knows at the time they're seeking payment. So if they know this is something that's important to the government, which might have come up in a discussion, might have come up in correspondence, it may have been identified in some sort of contractual term, that is that could be relevant to a determination of materiality. It also depends a little bit on what's in the mind of the government. What has been their prior practice in paying on this contract? For example, has the government routinely paid claims even though this contractor has violated this same regulatory provision or contractual provision in the past? And then more broadly, what has the government done with other similar claims and other similar contracts? So you could take into consideration whether a contracting officer or a program official has paid out claims to other government contractors or other participants in the program that might have had the same type of regulatory violations or statutory violations. So I think it's very broad, and it's certainly much tougher than it used to be. The court here repeatedly emphasized that materiality was a rigorous test, a demanding test. Those are words that have never been used to define or describe materiality in the past. My personal view is it's always been a very weak standard up until now. And I think this is a very, very different way of looking at it. It replaces some of the old test in a way of this idea of condition of payment. It also sort of incorporates some of the other checks out there that previously courts had looked to the knowledge of the government when it paid out a claim, but it was something that they considered into whether the defendant had the right scienter. In other words, if the defendant knew that the government knew of the violation, then it couldn't have the required scienter. Courts kind of rolling all that up into materiality, into a new and strengthened materiality element.
Yeah, absolutely. And one interesting aspect of that part of the opinion is not all of the primary violations of the False Claims Act refer to materiality. So the word materiality or material only appears in some of the violations of the False Claims Act. But the court basically read a materiality requirement into all of them. So and Justice Thomas wrote, we need not decide whether the actual statute's materiality requirement is governs the violations, you know, that's the natural tendency test, or whether it's derived from common law. So it basically said, you know, we're going to consider the entire False Claims Act to require some kind of materiality requirement that is basically equivalent to the common law. That is entirely different from what the statute indicates and how every other court had interpreted it. So it makes sense as one resolution of this kind of complicated issue, but it's certainly massaging the statute, you know, while they don't acknowledge it, it's certainly massaging the statute in a direction that is different than the literal language of it would indicate.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think what happened here is over the last several years, because Congress has watered down the False Claims Act to make it easier for the government and easier for relators to overcome some of the historical defenses of contractors and to recover where there's been fraud on the government, what they allege to be fraud in the government. Courts have kind of jumped through some hoops and contorted some of the elements, mixed them up, and come up with a variety of different tests to essentially create some checks on the False Claims Act and keep it from growing into an all-purpose fraud enforcement statute, which the Supreme Court has warned against on several occasions. And I think the court today was trying to get back to the elements of the statute, to get back to the language of the statute, and you know, really saying we're going to rigorously enforce materiality, we're going to rigorously enforce scienter, and even though we're expanding what is a false claim or fraudulent claim, we're not going to just, you know, create a green light for the government or open the floodgates to whistleblowers. We're going to put some checks in place that may not have been obvious from the language of the statute to create some semblance of balance between what the government or relators have to prove on one side and the way in which a contractor or other program participant could defend itself on the other side.
Yeah, I think that's very true, Mark. So just to sum up what the new test is for implied certifications, Now you have to ask, did the claim itself, the claim for payment, make specific representations about the goods or services provided? And number two, did the defendant fail to disclose, quote, material violations related to those representations that made nondisclosure fraudulent? So, you know, did you say something in the claim for payment that becomes deceptive if you fail to disclose contract or regulatory or statutory violations? And so if those elements are present, then the implied certification theory applies and may have violated the FCA. So that's the court's opinion in brief. It's a little bit in the weeds in terms of the interplay between the different statutory provisions, but hopefully that was kind of a helpful summary. I think now we'll take a few minutes to talk about some of the implications for this opinion, and then we'll open it up for questions. So, Mark, what do you think are some of the important implications of this opinion?
Well, I think there's something in this opinion for everyone. If you're on the government side or the whistleblower side, I think you see this as really opening the door to a wide range of new types of claims. With this idea of implied certification, there is endless possibilities to how you could turn a regulatory violation or statutory violation into a False Claims Act and try to get treble damages. You know, a lot of regulatory schemes are much lower in terms of the dollars that they can exact from a violation. And if you're a whistleblower, most regulatory schemes do not provide any private right of action. So this would give a lot of folks a lot of opportunities to recover money from those people doing business with the government where they otherwise might not. At the same time, I think there's a lot here for defendants, for those doing business with the government, to try and protect themselves and to push back on a new wave of litigation. I think, you know, repeatedly the court has emphasized it's not going to allow the False Claims Act to be used for insignificant regulatory violations. It can't be found where, you know, materiality can't be where noncompliance is minor or insubstantial. It doesn't apply to garden variety breach or regulatory violations, and it's not an all-purpose fraud enforcement statute. So, you know, I think there's something here for everyone, but the unfortunate part of this is that it's going to spawn a lot of new litigation. I think because this is such a different framework than what courts have used in the past, it's going to require a few years of, you know, the lower-level courts to really refine this analysis and understand where the balance ought to be between an implied certification and materiality.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, in my personal opinion, I think the court's limits on this theory are far less clear than they imagine. So, one of the important limits is the, contract breach or violation has to relate to a specific representation about the goods or services provided on the claim for payment. That puts a huge amount of emphasis on what the language of the claim for payment was. That's going to be so hard to apply. I mean, just thinking about, for a contract for an aircraft carrier, if they submit, a big claim for payment that says, a 30% progress payment on the project, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean you have to have fulfilled absolutely everything, related to what 30% of the progress means, so anything material in the beginning of a contract, suddenly becomes a False Claims Act issue. I mean, that's going to be very disputed. And I think in this instance, it was interesting that it was a healthcare case because healthcare codes are quite clear about what, the person requesting payment is representing happened. But most contracts are far less clear than that. And I also think that the standard is going to be unduly punitive to specifically the healthcare industry because lots of claims for payment are quite general with government contractors. However, healthcare, claims for payment list specifically absolutely everything that was done. And so any failure to do what you're supposed to under the regulations for any procedure is going to come under the False Claims Act rubric now. So I think it's not much of a limit and it's going to be very hard to understand.
Yeah.
One other thing, I also think the materiality standard is also going to be pretty unclear, because you're going to have to kind of predict what the government assess what the government has done in similar situations. So you'll have to analyze what they did on the rest of this contract, on all the other contracts. You know, can you say that, you know, that whether or not the Bureau of Land Management rejected fencing material is the same as whether or not DOD, you know, accepted a report prepared by a consultant? I mean, like, there's so many complex factual issues that you have to wade through. And that was one of the policy arguments that people used to say, this is a crazy theory, you just can't allow it at all. But the court really brushed that aside. And in a footnote near the end of the opinion, they basically said, you know, you'll still be able to dispose of these issues on motions to dismiss and summary judgment, because the plaintiff is going to have to plausibly plead materiality. So the plaintiff is going to have to plausibly plead that the government, you know, rejects similar claims or, you know, doesn't accept these. That's really just a whole new kind of, you know, ancillary inquiry that is now going to have to be policed by courts, and maybe very difficult to do on a motion to dismiss, because you have to take the allegations as true in the complaint and, you know, reasonable inferences in favor of the plaintiff. So I don't see how a court could throw something out on a motion to dismiss, because the plaintiff can throw in all the favorable facts they want and then get reasonable inferences.
You know, I think if you're a government agency, this is going to be a giant headache for you too, because now it brings into question not only what you paid out on this particular contract, but what you've paid out to anybody on any similar contract in the past. And I think they're going to have to get very consistent in the way they approach what is material to a claim, what is the basis for a payment on a claim, because, you know, discovery is going to be a nightmare. If you're a contracting officer, you're going to have to start answering questions about how you've paid out claims on different contracts. You're going to have to respond to interrogatories or document requests for all situations where you may have paid out a claim, even though there was a different type of violation that you were aware of. So I think it's going to be a mess for the government to deal with, because they can be very siloed, they can be very ad hoc, they don't often know what one hand is doing, the other hand doesn't know what one hand is doing. So I think it's going to be tough for the government to be able to say, you know, this was material to us and we would never have paid this claim had we known. Because you're going to have to defend that you've consistently done that, both on this contract and on every other contract like this.
Yeah, and I think the court's analysis taken from common law is very hard to apply to the modern federal government in some ways, because fraudulent omissions were, you know, that concept is developed in kind of an arm's length transaction where it makes sense, where, you know, one person talking to another. But when you're a healthcare provider submitting, you know, 1,000 claims a day to a giant bureaucratic process, saying, you know, something is a fraudulent omission looks very different. I mean, it's just a very different type of system. And so any violation, starts to look fraudulent. So I'll just make one final comment and then we'll open up for questions. We've gone a little long, so I appreciate your patience. One final thing is Congress can absolutely revise the False Claims Act if they don't like this opinion. And I think we'll have to wait and see if that's a real possibility. But in other False Claims Act decisions by the Supreme Court in the past 10 years, particularly the Allison Engine case, where Congress didn't like the Supreme Court's interpretation, they quickly passed an amendment just because this is such an important statute. Here, I'm not sure what Congress will think of it, because it does kind of cut both ways in a lot of avenues. So this could be, you know, moot if in 2 years or, you know, this year Congress passes an amendment. But right now it's just a very interesting new regime for the False Claims Act.
Yeah, it'll be the key person to watch usually in these situations is Senator Grassley. He was a big proponent of the last amendment. He chairs a committee, so he's got a lot of power to push through new legislation. Obviously, nothing has moved through Congress in recent years, but if the Supreme Court can be unanimous on something, then, you know, Congress certainly has the power to move on a bipartisan basis as well. So that is always a possibility, and you don't want to get your hopes up about relying on a case too much, because the Congress can always change the law.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for that summary and for the discussion of the implications. I do want to get the audience involved at this point. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me make a quick announcement about a call scheduled tomorrow that just got scheduled, actually. 2 days ago, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, not the Supreme Court, but the court here, decided the net neutrality case, long-awaited decision. We will have a telephone conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern time discussing that net neutrality decision. And, of course, the Supreme Court continues to decide important cases, high-profile cases, the rest of this month. So please monitor your emails and check the website of the Federalist Society for additional to-be-scheduled telephone conference calls. Today, of course, we're talking about the False Claims Act case. We've got one caller on the line. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call.
Hi, quick question. On the you talked about the bulked-up definition of materiality in the Escobar case, but in the healthcare field, I'm not seeing how this really changes the playing field much from a defendant's point of view. The factors you discussed, what matters to the government, what the defendant knows is important to the government, you know, what's in the mind of the government. If I'm a plaintiff's attorney or a relator, I would say the existence of any regulation, you know, however minor, the FDA, CMS, whatever, is going to be per se evidence that something is important to the government. In the healthcare industry, I assume any regulation out there would arguably be important to the government. So can you think of any examples where this new rigorous test really changes anything, at least with respect to the healthcare field?
Well, the court did actually weigh in on that and said that, you know, insignificant regulatory or contractual violations would not be material. So I think the court has set up at least an expectation that there are going to be some regulatory violations or even contractual violations that are not material in these situations, and that each district court's going to have to look at and make up its own mind as to which ones are material and which ones are not.
Yeah, and I think that healthcare actually has, I think, a different stance here. One, because their claims for payment are so specific, I think they will have much, they'll be a much bigger target for implied certifications. But then, as Mark said, I think this new materiality standard will apply broadly. As to the specific facts, I think there'll be just a huge range. I mean, there are, you know, regulations about not only, you know, how specific procedures are done, you know, in order to be eligible for claim for payment, but also, you know, like, you know, employment conditions, you know.
Environmental,
yeah.
Regulations. You know, there's a case a few years ago where a company had a services contract related to, I think it was photography or something, and they had been violating some environmental regulations related to the disposal of certain types of hazardous materials, something that seems pretty unrelated to the work they were performing for the government. And I think what would happen in those cases is it would become a factual debate as to whether the government has cared about that in the past, you know, and have they consistently rejected claims for one type of service or one type of good because of some apparently disconnected regulatory violation.
Yeah, and I do think that the regulatory requirements around specific services are going to be, you know, close to per se here. You know, if a particular code is used that indicates, you know, a physician performed a service as opposed to a nurse, I think that's probably going to be considered material because the government is paying for, you know, that type of qualified personnel, which is, and they ruled in this case that you have to have qualified personnel, you know, performing the service that you're getting paid for. So I think those types of regulations could easily, you know, become close to per se violations, but there are just so many other areas there's just employment conditions, you know, all kinds of regulations that are probably going to be considered irrelevant to what, you know, the actual claim for payment is.
At this point, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me ask a question. You mentioned at different points in your presentations that this was, of course, a unanimous decision. You also used a phrase, something like a whole new framework. And you also allowed for the fact that you were a little surprised it was a unanimous decision. How surprising is this? I mean, it seems to me the court's been using unanimous decisions when it proceeds by increments, and it's proceeding by increments in order that it can remain unanimous. But here you're seeing something, maybe I see change might be too dramatic a description, but from a unanimous court, how surprising is that? How significant is that?
Well, on one hand, it's surprising. On another hand, it's not. The recent history of the False Claims Act has been fairly unanimous. So I think Shane mentioned four of the last five decisions involving the False Claims Act were unanimous. The one that was not unanimous was something like 6-2 or 7-2. So it was an overwhelming majority. So for whatever reason, the False Claims Act has been an area where the Supreme Court's been able to come together and find common ground. But I do think this is a significant departure. Certainly there was a lot of dispute amongst the circuit courts as to whether to apply implied certification and when it was implied or applied, whether it needed to have certain limits on it using this condition of payment test. So it is a little surprising that there could be so much debate amongst the circuit courts and yet no debate at the Supreme Court, no dissent at the Supreme Court. And the fact that I think that they did away entirely with this condition of payment test, to me, was pretty important and pretty surprising. That was not something I think that either one of the parties would have expected. And then to go back to materiality, which I personally have given up on. I mean, if you look at the statute, it's so weakly written that it's almost not even worth fighting for. There were a few situations where we've had success in arguing materiality, but it was things like when, you know, the alleged violation had occurred, you know, after the payment as opposed to before the payment, something like that, where it's just impossible for the government to have considered the issue when making the payment. Otherwise, very little option for using that as a defense. So I think the fact that they've gone back to materiality and bulked it up and certainly emphasized its rigor and demanding standard is pretty significant and surprising, especially in a unanimous decision.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that this may be so discontinuous despite being unanimous is that the Supreme Court doesn't see a ton of these cases. You know, they take one a year or one every other year, whereas district courts and circuit courts have, you know, a few on their docket, like at any one time. And so they've had to really develop the case law, I think, pretty far in some respects. And also, I think they can see the practical problems with the court's approach here. Whereas, you know, the Supreme Court, they're saying, let's just look at the statute and, you know, import the common law definition of fraud for fraudulent omissions. That makes sense if you don't deal with these cases every day, and if this is the first time you're looking at it ever. But I think that's why they were in part, you know, willing to just kind of take a fresh look at it, because they haven't had that many cases and they don't see, you know, how this might be difficult.
I do think it was a bit ironic that they say, you know, we start as always with the language of the statute, but then they read in the common law, which is, you know, obviously not part of the statutory language. Gave them a lot of flexibility, but ultimately it helped them create a balance that I think is needed for the False Claims Act to succeed. It's got to provide the government with an effective vehicle for recovering money from companies or individuals that defraud them. But at the same time, there's got to be some fairness. There's got to be some defense for contractors or those participating in government programs to say that this can't be fraud. You know, this might have been a breach of contract, this might have been a regulatory violation, but this is not fraud and this is not treble damages. And this is not the kind of thing that ought to get us put on a suspension or debarment proceeding. So the ramifications of fraud or False Claims Act judgment are so severe, there's got to be some real balance. There's got to be enough of a check that the government or whistleblowers don't just run wild with it.
We do have a couple more listeners with audience questions, so let's take another call now. The caller, you might have your own telephone on mute. If you have your phone on mute, you need to come off mute.
Yes, I'm sorry. I wonder if you could comment about, for example, the Worthless Services series of cases under the False Claims Act regarding nursing homes and how you think this new materiality requirement will play into that worthless services theory, especially in an area like nursing homes where there's a very broad federal regulatory environment down to the width of doorways, et cetera, and it's very hard to tell what regulations could be material and what couldn't at first glance. So I was just hoping you'd comment on those aspects.
Sure. Well, I think you're right that it's going to be hard to figure out which, you know, regulations are material and which aren't. You know, I would think that the width of a doorway probably isn't, but at the same time, you know, if an entire nursing home is built wrong and three patients die because their beds can't get through a door, who knows? You know, it's going to be very unclear. I think the with regard to the worthless services, one way to think about kind of worthless services and worthless goods is as kind of a factual falsity issue, you know, where if you're submitting a claim for payment saying I gave you, you know, 10 computers, but in reality, you know, none of them work because they're missing, a component, you know, it's almost a factually false statement to say I gave you 10 computers. And so I think that was, you know, part of how people have thought about worthless services, you know, in the nursing home context. If you're just really not even providing the service on any meaningful level, it's basically a factual misrepresentation to say you did it. But when it's more of a nebulous, you know, peripheral regulatory violation, that doesn't really seem to make sense. And so I think you'll almost get to the same place with materiality, in the sense that really important violations that really impact, you know, the benefit of the government's bargain are going to come into implied certification, whereas kind of irrelevant ones won't. But the dividing line there is going to be entirely unclear. I think in the opinion, it talks about, you know, guns that don't shoot, that, you know, even if you give guns and they don't shoot, you know, even if you haven't said something specific about, you know, their ability to shoot, that's still fraud. Even in this opinion, they use language that's kind of similar to a worthless services or worthless goods type theory. I would imagine that theory will kind of shift ground and start to come under materiality instead. But yeah, I don't know.
We've got about 10 minutes left. We've got just one question pending. So if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, great presentation. Can you address the impact of this case on the pending Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces, or so-called blacklisting regulations, and how those reports that are going to be required of federal contractors, what the implications would be under this new decision you've addressed today?
So I have some familiarity with it. I know that requires you to make certain disclosures, both pre-award and then on a regular basis post-award. I would imagine that if you fail to make certain disclosures, you know, you use what the court here refers to as half-truths in your disclosures by, only reporting on certain positive things and not revealing all of the potential negatives, that's a problem for you. But I honestly don't know that we know enough about that statute or that pending regulation to really think it all the way through here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not as familiar with that as I would need to be. I would think my initial gut reaction is that it may not, you know, be material in the sense of this court's opinion, just because I think what the court is getting at is, you know, is the government getting the benefit of its bargain? And can you connect that to what was specifically said on the claim for payment? You know, so they said specifically they're providing therapy services, but if you didn't provide a therapist, then you're robbing the government of the benefit of its bargain, and then that's a material violation. You know, where it's like a reporting requirement, where you're fulfilling your you know, contractual performance obligations to the government, but you mess up a reporting requirement, I would think that that's not material. But that's, again, I don't really know enough about that specific regulation.
Although I'm sure there will be people out there who will claim it's material. Certainly there is going to be someone in the government or some whistleblower who's going to go right after you the first time they find a violation and test that out. I think that, I mean, that this is the kind of thing that is going to be litigated. There's going to be all kinds of regulations that, you know, on one side you can argue has nothing to do with the service or the good that was provided. And on the other side, the government, someone in the government's going to say, absolutely, this is the most important thing I look at, and it's absolutely vital to every claim I pay out. And that's going to have to be litigated, and I think there's going to be a lot of uncertainty as to whether these violations are material or immaterial.
Let me make another call for questions. Our lines are wide open. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting, let me ask what might be my final question. You mentioned that this is a new rubric that the court has come up with here, and that the lower courts really weren't looking at this as a potential outcome. Were any of the parties arguing in favor of this particular outcome, this particular set of tests?
Not exactly. So they had taken some different positions. I think both parties had agreed that omissions could, in some instances, lead to FCA violations, but none of them had argued for the standard. I would say this is probably closest to probably the Fourth Circuit's standard, because they had said, you know, violation of material contract provisions while submitting claims for payment can be a violation of the False Claims Act. But not quite in the way that the court has discussed the issues here, and they didn't say anything about connecting it to specific representations made in the claim for payment. So it lies in substance. It lies kind of between the parties' position in that the United States said, you know, there's an implied representation any violation can become, you know, an implied certification under the False Claims Act, where the government would have been entitled to deny payment. Like, not that they would have actually or, you know, practically or have generally, but really any time a violation allows the government to refuse payment, that's a violation of the False Claims Act. That would have been, you know, insanely broad. And so the court said definitely not that. And I think they talk about the government's in oral argument, they talked about a contractor that doesn't buy staplers from the United States. And they say, are you really going to say that you can come after someone for fraud, you know, in performing a contract if they didn't buy staplers from the right place? And so the court recognized the government's position was a little maximalist, but they, I think, kind of fell in the middle. But their test is definitely not something that was advocated for.
Yeah, if you read the decision, I haven't gone back and read all the arguments in the briefs recently. But if you read the decision, they spend most of the time just rejecting all the arguments from both sides.
I don't see another question from the audience, so let me conclude by letting each of you wrap up. If you have a final thought, take a minute or two.
Sure. So I think one kind of key takeaway is I think this is really going to create a whole new set of issues for both compliance and False Claims Act litigation with the federal government, and it really just hugely impacts all government contractors and healthcare providers providing services under Medicare and Medicaid, because the operations and compliance has been set up over the past, you know, few decades based on a certain set of assumptions, and they're all about to be shifted. And so, everyone who does business with the government is going to have to figure out, well, what violations might be material? What am I really saying on my claims for payment? And that you're going to have kind of a flurry of analysis internally to try and adjust policies and procedures to meet this new standard so that you can avoid the punitive regime of the False Claims Act. So this is going to be a cascade of other issues that need to be resolved.
I agree. I think it's going to spawn all kinds of litigation. I think you're going to see this case cited in every single brief anyone ever writes in a False Claims Act case, whether you're on the government or relator side arguing that you know, anything is potentially a violation, or on the defense side, arguing that each of the elements requires a rigorous or demanding or strictly enforced standard. So this, you're going to see this case cited repeatedly. I think we're going to be talking about it for a long time, and I think it's going to take a few years before it shakes out and we start to understand what all the real implications are and how they're applied at the lower levels.
Sounds like a clear win for the attorneys. let me thank you both for joining us today, Shane Kelly and Mark Sweet, both of Wiley Ryan right here in Washington, D.C. This has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you for the audience to the audience for dialing in as well and for your questions. A reminder, next week is another big decision week in the court. We'll be scheduling telephone conference calls accordingly. And don't miss tomorrow's telephone conference call at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing the very important net neutrality decision of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.